episode of Pit Lane Parlay.
Welcome to another episode of Pit Lane Parlay. My name is host Mike Jokum. Jess and Matt join me, and we are here to discuss everything Indy 500 and a couple other news and notes along the way. Guys, how are we doing tonight?
Good.
I'm doing okay.
All right. I will turn it over to Matt and let him bring up the first point of discussion.
I mean, I don't really know how we're supposed to feel after the Indy 500 because, I mean, it's honestly the best day of the year and we all enjoy the race so much, but then you like realize after the race that the Indy 500 is over and that the month of May is coming to an end, and it's all kind of sad. And for you two to get to witness that race, I'm really jealous of you guys because it was amazing on TV. But if you're living under a rock, Simon Pagenaud didn't win the race from pole position after an epic battle there with Alexander Rossi at the end of the race. Overall, there was a couple of surprises in the field that we'll discuss here in a bit, a couple of incidents we're going to recap, get our takes on some things that we saw during the race and whatnot. But Jess, as far as your initial thoughts on the race, what'd you think? Racing looked good? Everything looked good from your point of view?
Yeah, I thought it was a great race, especially the beginning and the end. Typical of the Indy 500, it got a little bit quiet, we'll say, in the middle. Everybody kind of settled in and it was a little bit calm, I guess you can say, for a while. But the beginning and the end were just fantastic.
Yeah, I agree with Jess, and shout out to patron Jake Neely, who was texting me during the race that he was a little bored in the middle, and I said, listen, they're just biding their time until they attack, and attack they did at the end there. So great race. I think, you know, Firestone and IndyCar did a great job to improve on any issues last year, and I don't know who was praying to the rain gods to hold it off, but it worked out better than anybody expected weather-wise on Sunday.
Yeah, is it too early to pitfall the weathermen? I mean, how do we get that wrong so badly? But I guess we can't really complain. I'd rather them get it wrong the right way than to say it's going to be sunny and then have it downpour the entire day. And I had a couple of people on Twitter too, because I said right away from the first couple of restarts, when I'm like, this racing is excellent. This is going to be a good race. And then it did get a little slower for a couple stints, and everybody's like, oh yeah, who's talking now? I'm like, give it some time. It's just the middle of the race. They're just settling in. And of course, you know, definitely the second half of the race is really good. Mike, off the top of your head, where would you rank this amongst the recent Indy 500s, maybe like last decade or so?
You know, I've been staring at this note since we typed up our notes beforehand. It's definitely, I'm going to say, in the top four in the past decade. And that's, you know, non-scientific without remembering specific years. But, you know, obviously 2011, which was exactly 8 years ago today, as of this recording, has to be, you know, a podium finisher. But, you know, it's definitely up there. The beginning was great. The end was great. And what I found pretty interesting was through the pit stop cycles, you got guys kind of racing with each other, you know, as they came out of the pits. So there was some intrigue in the middle, or at least most of the middle until it slowed down. So I'm going to say maybe third or fourth overall in the past 10 years.
Yeah, I pulled up the past 10 years, just kind of jogged my memory here, but I would say probably fourth, maybe fifth, just kind of thinking back. But yeah, definitely in the top half. It was very good. The racing was way better than the past couple years, so I was very happy with it.
I'm going to go third. I'm going to go behind the 2014 Indy 500 and the 2017 Indy 500, which is no disrespect to this year's, because I thought this year's was excellent. So it's very good that us three / other people out there are definitely, you know, recognizing right away that, you know, this race is definitely up there with some of our favorites from recent memory, which is never a bad thing. I don't think a whole lot of people were saying that about last year's race, so that's definitely good. All right, let's just go ahead and roll through some of our talking points here. First of all, again, I don't know if we said it, but congratulations to Simon Pagenaud for winning the Indianapolis 500. Definitely a career-defining moment for him. And to go off script a little bit here, just a quick maybe 10 words or less answer. Jess, do you think Simon Pagenaud maybe saved his job at Team Penske for next season?
Well, I don't know that his job was ever really on the line like some people had been talking about. I kind of had said that before. You know, Penske typically gives them a little bit of time to settle in. But obviously at the press conference afterwards, that I was kind of trying to keep up with. I even tweeted that Penske said that absolutely he'll be back next year. So if his job was on the line, he clearly saved it.
Yeah, I think Jess put it right there. I was a little more skeptical than Jess was going into the month of May. Obviously, even if Roger Penske didn't come out and blatantly say it in less than 10 words, yes.
I was getting pretty close to hitting the panic button. So I was one of those who said that he was definitely under threat, especially from Rossi, who's becoming a free agent. But no, I don't think he's going anymore. So good job, Simon. Great job. And we're really happy for you. As far as one of the talking points after the race, as far as the blocking, quote unquote, with Pagenaud, Pagenaud weaved twice or maybe three times down the back straightaway on the last lap. Mike, what is your stance on if there was or should not have been a blocking call on Pagenaud?
Yeah, I don't see it. I mean, I watched it live. Jess and I watched it that night, and I watched it again the next day. So I have now watched the race three times. I believe Pagenaud was proactive in each one of his moves, and you can make as many proactive moves as you want. So, there's no rules to say after two proactive moves you have to stop. So I see no issue with it. I get why, Rossi is frustrated, but I don't think that's blocking.
Yeah. Like you mentioned, I watched it at least three times, probably more than that, cause it was all over social media too. I saw nothing that made me think he was blocking. He was always moving beforehand. And frankly, I was listening to Rossi's radio, and he was told to do the same thing when he was out in front, break the line. So I don't think that anybody really should be faulting Simon. I mean, this is the Indianapolis 500, so no, I didn't think it was blocking.
I think Rossi said the same thing after the race too. He said, I would have done the same thing. So yes, I'd say last 30 laps and under for the Indianapolis 500 or just about any race. I'm one of those, anything goes as long as you don't put anybody in danger. And it's not like Pagenaud was out there wrecking anybody. So yes, all proactive, nothing reactionary. Good job by race control to not throw a penalty in our opinions here. One of the most controversial moments of the day happened between Graham Rahal and Sebastian Bourdais. The two were heading towards turn three at the end of the day or end of the race. They were battling for, I believe, somewhere in the sixth or seventh range for position. And Bourdais and Rahal make contact and sent them both into the wall. Bourdais had a pretty heavy contact with the left side of his car. And then it also collected Veach, Rosenquist, Kimball, and then Dixon also got a little bit of damage in there. But Dixon was able to continue, as was Kimball, after a little bit of repairs. Jess, as far as what you saw from the incident there, is there one person at fault? Do you think Rahal overreacted? Do you think he was, quote-unquote, fair in his reaction? What are your kind of thoughts about the whole incident?
I think that he overreacted a bit. I think that it was more of a racing incident than Bourdais trying to squeeze him down. But I feel like he wasn't quite where Bourdais would have been able to see him. And maybe Bourdais wasn't getting exact position from his spotter because, they are kind of far away in some areas. So I think, frankly, in my point of view, it was closer to a racing incident than anything.
Yeah, you know, at first when we were at the track, I thought, wow, you know, Bourdais messed up, and I got why Ray Hall was so frustrated. And the more I've watched that incident, and, you know, between watching the replay and seeing it on social media, God, I don't know, 800 times in the past couple days here, Ray Hall really, you know, his front tire is just about at Bourdais' rear tire as they go into turn three and make that first bit of contact. So does he have a right to be frustrated? Yeah, sure. His race ended early. Was Bourdais at fault? I don't know. He's taking the normal line he took into the turn every other lap that race, and maybe him and his spotter both got a little surprised by Ray Hall's aggressiveness there. So like Jess said, I think this is one of those racing incident type deals.
Yeah, I'm looking at a replay right now, actually, just to jog my brain, because I was trying to pinpoint when Ray Hall ducked to the inside to make his move, and I don't know. I thought it was a fair bit of distance from turn three. I don't think it was last second by any stretch. Ultimately, I do agree that it is one of those racing deals. I think, you know, Bourdais did chop down on him a little bit there, but I think, as Bourdais said in his comments after the fact, he said, you know, I wasn't going to go stick myself in the marbles just because Grant Pick, you know, decided to duck down sort of last second. So I see both sides. I do tend to side with the guy who is trying to pass in these situations. And in this case, I think, you know, Ray Hall was making a legitimate, you know, chance to pass, and I don't think it was desperate by him, but I also see where Bourdais is coming from. So yeah, I think at the end of the day, we can chalk up the racing incident, but I do like Graham's passion, and him pumping up the crowd for some reason was cool to me. I don't know why, but
yeah, I felt like a hockey game watching that.
Right. He's still got the balaclava on. He's, I don't know if his like helmet was off at that point. It was like still dangling at his chest, but to see him so pumped up, and it just, you know, shows how much it means to him that he loves to do it for the fans. And then, like I had said, that Zach Veach was involved in that crash and did have a knee injury. We got very vague news at first that he was just being evaluated for his knee and that he was not cleared to drive. And there was a little panic on Twitter as far as, you know, a guy like Connor Daly, who just had a great race, is he going to jump into that ride for Detroit? I refrained from saying that on Twitter, but I was like, well, it's way too early to start speculating. And then later that night, Veach had tweeted out that he's fine and that he should be ready for Detroit. So no worries there. So it's good that Zach Veach is, and everybody else involved in the wreck is okay. One of the, I don't know if I would call it funniest, one of the most entertaining parts of the race was watching Alexander Rossi and Oriol Servia battle it out towards the last third of the race. Rossi was on the lead lap. I think he was like in sixth or so. And Servia was a lap down, and Rossi was trying to pass him multiple times on the front straightaway and kept getting dang near put in the wall on the front straightaway. Mike, just go ahead and I don't even know how to segue you into this, so just go ahead and share your thoughts on that.
Yeah, this one, you know, and Servia's usually a pretty, respectful driver, and I get, you know, his defense online and saying, you know, hey, if I'm a lap down, I can fight for my lap back. Sure, but you're not going to fight your lap back with the guy in sixth place, A, and B, you can fight for your lap back without trying to put somebody into the wall. And when you kind of shove Rossi down as low as you did, that to me is just a dirty move. And I get why Rossi and a couple other guys were very angry at Servia during and after the race. And I hope that's something IndyCar and race control looks at. I don't mind that, you know, lap traffic can, or lap cars can, you know, fight for the lap back. That's totally cool. But you also have to, you know, be respectful of the people around you and not, you know, fake to try to put them into a wall. I think that was just not a good move.
And Poor Rossi had a rough day with people who were lapped. So Servia, that whole incident was obviously completely ridiculous, in my opinion. And his social media like explanation about how he's allowed to, you know, keep fighting for his position. Well, he wasn't actually fighting for his position. They are allowed to fight for position if the person trying to pass them, you know, is going to take their position, but he clearly was not. So I was actually really shocked that IndyCar didn't step in there. And also with Elio, because everybody knew that Elio was just basically holding him back to let his teammates have a better chance. And frankly, I thought that was a good word to put here. That's
egregious.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was going to say everything that I can think of is not allowed on this show. so yeah, what he did was just uncalled for, in my opinion. And I was a little disappointed, that IndyCar didn't do anything about either of those drivers holding Rossi up.
Are you telling me that Elio Castroneves did something shady on track? No.
I wouldn't say it was shady necessarily. I mean, that's kind of what teammates are meant to do. However, he was not in a position to be fighting for a position at that point. So I didn't care for it.
Fair. And as far as the Rossi Serbia, I agree with everything you guys had said. So the only thing I'll add on to that is that usually in these situations, you just say what goes around comes around. However, I don't think Oriol Servia will be battling for a win anytime soon, so I don't know if it'll ever come back around for him. So I guess if he just wants to keep driving that way, it's going to continue to make some people upset in the paddock. But again, I don't see Servia coming back to the Indy 500 and winning anytime soon. So that's just my two cents on that. As far as Elio Castroneves, speaking of him, one of the more controversial race control decisions in the race was the penalty that Elio Castroneves received for his collision with James Davison. For those who missed that, Castroneves was coming into the pits, as was Davison, and Davison was slowing down for his pit stall, and looking at the incident objectively, it looked like Davison honestly was going to miss his pit box from what it looked like, and he really slammed on his brakes, and then Elio, who was right behind him in the fast lane, which is the right lane, did hit Davison into one of his tires and spun him around, and Elio had front wing damage. Davison had a very long pit stop, and then they gave the penalty to Davison. So as far as that whole incident, Jess, what do you make of the penalty and the incident itself?
They gave the penalty to Castroneves, right? Not Davison?
Correct. Yep.
Okay. I'm sorry. I misheard you. I thought you said Davison. Okay. So, yeah. I think I saw it a little bit differently than you did. Because when you're at speed, you need to use the outside lane. He was starting to slow down, but as he was starting to slow down, Elio was released from his pit box, which, frankly, I thought was poor decision on Penske's part. So Davison really couldn't get over to the slower lane to slow down and hit his hitbox. That's kind of how I saw it. So he didn't really have a choice, because otherwise he was obviously going to pass it and have to go around and try again. I think he probably assumed that Elio knew where he needed to turn in, and obviously Elio didn't. but yeah, I didn't see that as wrong on IndyCar's part. I thought they were accurate. Frankly, I wouldn't necessarily blame Elio. I would have blamed the pit crew for releasing him when they did. But obviously, it could have gone either way, but that's how I saw it.
Yeah, this is a tough one. And every time I watch it, I get a slightly different opinion. If this was on the track, I would call it a racing incident. So there, NBC Sports tweeted out a 28-second clip of the incident, I will share this with Matt, so maybe he can post it on Twitter, but at the 4 second mark, if you pause it, it looks like Davison has a chance to get in his pit box. Then again, he's also in the fast lane at the same time Elio is coming up to speed. I feel like this is, you could almost just blame both of them in this case. You know, Davison's pit speed limiter isn't working, so he's slow and maybe overshoots his pit box. Elio gets released a little early and maybe isn't really focused on the fact that Davison's going slower than he should be. So do I agree with the penalty? Not really. I think this is I don't know if you call it a pit racing incident, but I would have just kind of let it go as, you know, listen, Elio needs his front wing replaced, and I think that's penalty enough.
Yeah, that last part is key. I think, you know, it was one of those things where it was just an honest incident or miscommunication, if all else, and definitely not up to either driver's fault. So to give one of them a penalty is, to me, a little absurd. And like I said on Twitter, I am nowhere near an Elio Castroneves fan. In fact, if I had not picked him in fantasy IndyCar, I may have been doing a silent fist pump that he got a penalty. However, I still think he got, I think, the wrong end of the deal there. And I mean, I'm watching the 28 second thing there, the NBC Sports clip. And I mean, as he's starting to turn in, I mean, I don't even think he's going to make it inside that right rear tire, even without Elio hitting him. So to me, I still think he was going to miss.
Yeah. Even in the screenshot I just sent, which we'll share, if he makes it, it's going to be really close, but he was probably going to hit one of those tires.
Really close. So, but, you know, obviously Castroneves hitting him is worse news, because worse comes to worse, the Davison Pickard just has to kind of rigmarole him around a little bit and, you know, cost themselves maybe like 15, 20 seconds, not the two laps it took him to turn him around. So it still ended up badly for both of them, but I still think Castroneves kind of got the bad end of the stick there. So maybe we'll make that our Twitter poll of the week, if it was quote unquote Davison's fault, Castroneves' fault, or if it was just one of those racing incidents, no fault kind of things. And we'll see what your guys' responses are to that. I'm trying to remember, what was our Twitter poll last week? Oh, who was the best story from the 8500 bump day? I think Kyle Kleiser won that by a landslide, which was...
That was me.
That was you?
Yeah,
you are correct. You and your shoe-ins, I tell you what. Wait, who do we pick for the Indy 500? Because I know I had Colton Herta, poor guy.
I had Hildebrand.
He lasted three laps. Hildebrand did not have his best day. And Jess said, shoot.
I want to say Rossi, but...
All right, so Jess
sounds all right,
because we can't remember.
Yeah, okay, we're just going to take your word for it, because I'm pretty sure...
I picked him in, like, everything, so I'm going to say I probably picked him for that, too.
Oh, okay. Well, since we're bragging a little bit, I'm actually having a pretty stellar fantasy IndyCar year after having a rough start in the elimination zone for the first two races. I think I'm like sixth now, and I think you guys are somewhere buried in the 20s.
I only have one thing to say about that.
What's that?
It's still early.
It's still early, but I'd say after Detroit, it's no longer early. So, I mean, we're getting into the thick of the season, and I really don't want to buy a Marco Andretti shirt, especially after what we witnessed on Sunday, which we'll get to here in a second. But but anyways, another pit incident, two more to kind of call out here. The one was with Will Power. He slid through his box, a little fuzzy on exactly what exactly happened. If he like hit the fuel hose or hit a tire, hit an air jack, I'm not sure what exactly happened, but two of his crewmen ended up being knocked over, not hurt in any way or anything like that. And then he slid over the air hose as well and was given not a drive-through. He was sent to the rear of the field before a restart and seemed very confused about the penalty. Didn't realize it was so severe. Made some willpower-ish 2010 types comments after the race, but then it didn't end up, you know, owning up to it later on. So good on him. So not much to comment on there. And then a really brutal injury happened at Jordan King's pit. He actually misjudged his pit entry and hit a tire into what looked like the quad leg area of one of his crewmen who had to be hospitalized for surgery. Last report we saw was that the surgery went well and the crewman's doing okay, so that's really good to hear, but that was a pretty scary incident there. So not the best day on pit road. I don't know if you guys have anything to comment on that before we move on here.
Just hats off to Willpower. You know, I don't know if he hit the fueler or if he hit the fuel hose that kind of partially knocked over there his fueler, but you can obviously see the guy kind of like his leg buckles a little bit, obviously not as much as the unfortunate Jordan King incident, but you hear those comments after the race and you're going, come on, man, just watch the replay. And then obviously he did. And so, you know, props to Power. It takes a lot to come out and admit it. I know when he talked to race control and they kind of said, just watch the tape. He ran out of there. He said he ran out of there quicker than he ever has before. So I wish I saw that, but still, you know, and also another props to him for, you know, keeping his head down and battling back to finish fifth, P5, I think. Let me check here. Yeah, P5.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that overall everybody is okay. Obviously a surgery due to a leg injury is not good, but he's gonna make a recovery. And then yeah, with the Power incident, honestly after watching that a couple times, I don't know how he didn't feel that he hit him, because from the tape it almost looks like he totally runs over his foot. So I'm glad that he admitted fault, like you said, and kind of just gave up. But that could have been so much worse than it was. So luckily, you know, everybody seems to have made it out mostly in one piece.
Well, yeah, 2010 Willpower would not have commented on the fact that he left race control in a hurry, admitting fault. So that was good to see. Another one of the kind of bummer moments of the race was the crash with Kyle Kaiser towards the 60-70 lap range. Looked like he was maybe forced a little high by Sage Karam, and then didn't you do the normal slide up into the wall and pancake the wall because of the marbles? He actually looked like he just got into the kind of dirty lane there and spun the rear end and crashed. Almost saved it, but unfortunately did slide back around. Willpower did a great job of missing him, but an unfortunate end to the Cinderella story of, you know, their campaign, even though they'll still be remembered in history as the team that knocked out Alonso. Jess, just real quick, do you think we see Juncos the rest of the season in any other races in IndyCar?
Yeah, I do. I don't know. Obviously, I think it's going to be a minute, but yeah, I feel like we'll see him again. Kind of have to after their story in May.
I hope maybe their sponsorship that they, you know, all the sponsorship that they added for the car in May gives them maybe more than just Laguna Seca at the very end of the year, because it would definitely be a shame if they took the next, unfortunately took the next essentially 3 months off until a race. Maybe if they can get something in July, at least to break it up to every 6 weeks they have a race. But yeah, we'll definitely see them again. I hope it's more than once, but you know, I'm not going to get my hopes up on that one just yet.
Yeah. Maybe we'll see our buddy Agustin Canapino. Who knows? But moving on. So we're kind of on a streak of bummers here, but another bummer was Colton Herta's retirement in the third or fourth lap gearbox failure. Really bummer for him, starting second row, and a lot of high hopes for him. And you know, I was really excited to see his aggressive style out there. But unfortunately, he didn't make it very far in the race due to no fault of his own. And then a terrific comeback for Takuma Sato. I think early on in the race, he had a cut tire based on what the broadcast was telling us. And I think he went one full lap down, manages to bounce back after that big crash with Bourdais and Ray Hall. All of a sudden, he was like top five. And I was asking my parents, I'm like, where the heck did he come from? So good on Sato for an epic comeback in the race his legacy is already cemented, but to kind of back up his 2017 performance with another solid performance is definitely good, especially after the crash last year. I had no faults of his own. So Mike, I don't know if you have comments on Herta or Sato there.
Well, first off, when my dad texted me that Sato was in fourth place, I guess at the time, I thought he was joking. And I thought I was seeing double for a second. So, yeah, amazing comeback. You know, no attack, no chance, was in full display. You know, coming from a, what was it, two laps down, I believe, and Colton Herta. I mean, the kid just can't catch a break the last three races now. You know, he has that fuel pickup issue, and Barber makes a mistake in Long Beach. I don't remember what he did in the Indy Grand Prix. He finished okay, right?
He was spun and then clipped by Hunter Ray.
He didn't finish that race. Right, right, right. And now, you know, he's the first guy out of the Indy 500 in lap four. And you, seeing him as frustrated as he was, you know, hearing it on the radio and then seeing it in the interview, you know, during or after the race, I forget. You can't blame the kid. They qualify in the top 10 just about every week, and just bad luck has struck three out of the last four races.
Yeah, the words he used in the radio were pretty choice, and I can't blame him. I mean, it was not his fault, and yeah, I mean, he needs Lady Luck to kind of smile on him. And Sato, man, he's so good at Indy. Like, he's just got it figured out. I mean, obviously, you know, he didn't quite make it up there to run with Rossi and Pagenaud, but he gave it his all and he got really close. So he is just impressive to watch there.
So Jess, what's the opposite of being good at Indy?
Not being good at Indy. Oh wait, it's being Andretti.
Oh, wow. Weird segue into Marco Andretti. How that honestly was one of the worst Indy 500 performances I've ever seen, outside of someone crashing within the first 10 laps because of like a spin or something. To be, what was it, five laps down to your teammates who, A, you got a guy coming up, you know, from basically off the streets from last year, to the fifth car at your team who ran in the top seven all day and finished 10th basically on a kind of a rough restart at the end, but, you know, had a killer race. Rossi was amazing. Hunter Ray had a pretty properly terrible car and came back and finished 8th somehow. Veach was running 12th, 13th, having an okay day. It wasn't like he was doing anything amazing, but, you know, he was keeping it together, and then got collected in the Bourdais Ray Hall crash. And to have the guy who's been there since 2006 to be five laps down, I just don't understand it. And I don't understand where this optimism of people saying this is Marco's year and things like that, when he comes out and does this, and he, you know, 2 years ago, well, everybody's good except for Marco, and 3 years ago, everybody was good except for Marco, and they put the wrong tires in the car. It's like, oh, you can tell I'm frustrated because I'm so sick and tired of hearing about how it's going to be Marco's year, and then for him to go out and just finish five laps down.
I want to know what they did to the car between carb day and the race change-wise, because they obviously, either somebody in the crew was drunk when they did it, or I don't know, but when you end up getting 10 turns of front wing in your car by the end of the race and you still are that off the pace, I don't know who made these changes. Was it Marco? Was it the team? But somebody deserves to lose their job after a performance that's that pitiful. You almost, at least I did, you feel bad because it was, you know, compared to, I mean, all four other cars. I know Veach, you know, like you said, Matt, wasn't, you know, running amazing, but he was finally, you know, having a decent race running up towards the first half of the field and in contention to finish in the top 10, maybe until he got collected. But, you know, Marco by lap one was seven positions back. I think I remember it was either six or seven spots he had lost in the first lap. So it's not like it got worse as the race went on. It was bad and stunk the entire race. And it's almost, I would just like to know what happened, you know, what changes were made that made the car that bad.
Well, I think the place we should start at is the one thing that hasn't changed there, and that is the driver.
The common denominator.
Yeah, car has changed. The number has changed. The color of the car has changed. The whole pit crew has changed. The owner technically has now changed. Like the one common denominator is him. And you said you feel bad. I do not feel bad for him because it's, again, common denominator here. He's been pretty bad for a really long time. He's lucked into some really good finishes, and usually that's what it is. It's luck. And frankly, luck is not going to save you anymore in the series with as stacked as the field is. And, you know, I hate to say it, but I'm pretty sure it's time for him to look at this as an owner and start reevaluating what he needs to do to get his car winning so that, you know, he has some income from that and not just dumping money into it.
And yeah, before we move on to the next topic, just like as Mike said, like you have, what was it, like 7 or 8 sessions to figure out your car. Obviously you got to focus a little bit on qualifying, but a team like Andretti probably put a little more emphasis into their race setup. You have Carb Day on Friday, which is 2 whole days before the race. What happened between Carb Day and the Indy 500? Because it was immediate. It was lap 2. He was 7 places down from where he started. And I said immediately, like, oh, there goes Marco. I don't know if it's a problem or I don't know if he's just playing conservative. But it was apparent immediately that the car was not good. And something like that just doesn't happen between Carb Day and the Indy 500 unless it's like what Colton had, like a gearbox failure, engine failure, something just amazingly catastrophic like that. And I just don't understand how that just keeps happening to Marco. So I guess that's what I'll say with it. And again, we're extremely disappointed and slash a little bit confused or maybe not even surprised a little bit. But man, I guess for all you Marco fans, there's always next year. Am I right? I mean, we've been saying that every year since 2006, that there's always next year. So just like the Cubs for 100-something years. But moving on, quick shout-out to Santino Ferrucci, who was the Indianapolis 500 Rookie of the Year. He drove a fantastic race, was really aggressive. Two of his big highlights were beating Kanaan out of the pits in the, I don't even know what you call it, the warm-up lane, to beat him out of the pits and fight with him and to get the advantage over an Indianapolis 500 winner like that was super cool to watch. And then his accident avoidance of the Bourdais Rahal crash, cutting through the grass and giving it the beans was super cool to watch, so good for him. And then to kind of segue again, one more kind of topic there to discuss was also with the Rahal Bourdais crash. I was sitting at home super frustrated, and I recall people saying that at the track there are fans booing because the red flag, because they red flagged the Rahal Bourdais crash. They lifted the red flag at lap 181 and the restart didn't come until 7 laps later. Now, Jess, what are your thoughts about it taking 7 laps to have lead lap cars pit, lap down cars pit, to reshuffle the field, to give them a couple laps to warm up the tires? I mean, do you think there might be a chance to look at that to improve that for future races?
Yeah, I mean, frankly, the fact that they didn't pit everybody at the same time was ridiculous to me. And then the whole reshuffling, I mean, it took every time somebody came on the radio again, it was like, okay, we still got a couple more, like, it's going to be one more lap. And then they'd come around, okay, we got 3 more that need to get, like, what are you guys doing? Like, I mean, frankly, I wasn't happy that it went red anyways. I understand what they were attempting to do. They were attempting to not have a shootout. Well, guess what? You ended up with one anyways. So I didn't, that whole series of events, I just was, yeah, like you said, I was very frustrated with the whole ordeal.
Yeah. You know, and quick shout out, Kyle Novak explained it on Marshall Pruitt's podcast. And even after listening to that, it's still frustrating. But I do think this is a good learning experience for race control to kind of look over the procedure. If they have to reorder cars, why can't you do it under the red flag? Or why can't you do it right after the red flag? Say, listen, you have to hold for a second, let this other guy go around you. Like, there has to be a better way to, you know, get that stuff sorted out. So hopefully they do look at it, and I'll just leave it at that.
Perfect. And then, so that's pretty much all it is with the Indianapolis 500 that we have to discuss. So thanks for listening along. Like we said, amazing race. We loved it. Can't wait for next May already. This May was pretty cool for me personally. And then for Jess and Mike to be at the track, super jealous. Hope you guys enjoyed the view from the media center and wherever else you were for the race. And then one quick thing to check on as well is that there was a report, I don't know if it was prior to the race or after the race, that 5 engine manufacturers, OEMs, were at the Indy 500 as a host, or were being hosted by IndyCar to watch the race and to get the lay of the land and whatnot. And Jess, I know there was one that in particular that we want to discuss a little further as far as what we could tell, that possibly potentially might be one of the 5, if you want to discuss that.
Yeah, I don't necessarily know that it's one of the 5, quote unquote. I don't even know if 5 has been confirmed by anybody, but the one that we want to discuss, and I'm probably going to butcher all of these names, so bear with me here. It's I'm not sure if it's Mullen or Mullen, but they are based out of Southern California, and they are a electric car company. They're getting ready to release the K50. Yeah, the K50. They had supposedly had so much traffic from their commercials that were played during the 500 that it crashed their website. So that's pretty cool. But the video of this car is actually pretty amazing. Just the street car that they're releasing will go almost 200 miles an hour. And it is an electric car. So do they have the technology? I think very possibly. Do they have the resources to be able to make this happen? I'm going to say not yet, simply because they are a brand new company. But it is nice to see them kind of, you know, they quote unquote sponsored the 500. They had the blimp was their logo, and then they had some commercials during the 500. So it's nice to see them at least trying to get involved. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. But as far as I can tell, they are pretty much wholly electric cars. I don't think I can't find anything that they're doing anything hybrid yet. And I can't find anything that they are interested in doing anything hybrid, but definitely something to keep your eye on.
And before Mike goes real quick, it was Adam Stern who said hosting the 5 engine manufacturers. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah. However you say it, Mullen or Mullen, you know, it's cool to see them, you know, putting some sponsorship out there when we've never heard of them before. At least I haven't. And I think it was patron Michael Goodyear who pointed it out to us originally, since Jess and I were at the track watching the race. But something definitely to keep an eye on from, you know, maybe an unknown, maybe they partner with you know, somebody more well-known with more resources and combine forces for some sort of OEM.
One more thing to point out, because I just had a tiny heart attack when I pulled this up. This car is going to start retailing. A base price is $124,999. So there's that.
Jeez. Yeah, so again, hopefully one of the 5 bites, and we can get a third OEM back in IndyCar here. Hopefully something better than Lotus. All right, Mike, let's get some Patreon shout-outs going here.
All right, let's see here. I'm going to start with thank you, Michelle. Thank you to Mr. Mike Knapp. Thank you, Mike Silver, both who provided great written coverage all month of May. Thank you to Sean Crawford, Stephen Clark, Mr. Stephen King. Always good to see you, and great photos taken at the Indy 500. If you guys haven't seen Steve's work, definitely check it out. Jess's dad, also Steve. Thank you, Steve. And thank you to Matt's brother-in-law, Tyrone. This was a very family-oriented Patreon shout-out today.
We love it. All right, moving on here, real quick, Detroit preview. As Jim Aiello once said, it's kind of one of the, I don't know what he said specifically, but basically Detroit tends to drag on a little because everybody's usually exhausted from the Indianapolis 500. So it totally makes sense that Mike, Jess, and I will all be there. So if you see us in the paddock or anything like that, feel free to wave, say hi. We got some fun activities planned and things like that, so we'll keep you guys in the loop on social media. But yeah, as far as the championship goes, to kind of reset everything now that all the crazy Indianapolis 500 stuff is done, Simon Pagenaud actually has the championship lead, believe it or not, followed by Newgarden, Rossi, Sato, Dixon, Power, Hunter Ray, Piggott, and Ferrucci. No Harvey or Ben Hanley this weekend. So Ben Hanley, who did sneak into the Indy 500 and retired, and Jack Harvey, who has, I believe, raced all but, I think he's raced every race so far this year. Now his part-time is starting to kick in, so he won't be at the track for a couple weekends. Last year's winners of the duel in Detroit, we had Hunter Ray for one race and Scott Dixon for the other. Jess, as far as who you think is going to win and who you think is going to do poorly, who do you got for this weekend?
Oh, man. Okay. So am I picking for both races at one time here?
I was about to rudely interrupt you, but you're smarter than me. So, yes, I would say if you wanted to maybe throw out one or two names for who you think's going to win.
I'm going to go with winners here. Probably going to see Bourdais, and I'm going to say Ferrucci. I mean, he's coming off of a good race. He's got a good head of steam going into it, so I think he's going to do well. Now, as far as doing poorly, I'm going to go with Max Chilton. I think he's going to be pretty shaken from not getting into the 500, and he's going to need some time to kind of get his confidence back, I guess. And then I'm also going to say, I hate to do it to him, but Marco's going to have another really poor showing 2 weekends in a row.
Well, I am glad I'm not agreeing with Jess on this one. In fact, I'm going the exact opposite. I think that the Dale Coyne cars may struggle this weekend. They did not have a good showing in either race last year. And I know Ferrucci kind of got punted by Charlie Kimball in, I believe, the first race. So maybe not a great indicator, but Bourdais finished out of the top 10 in both races in 2018. In terms of who's going to do well, I'm thinking we see at least one Alex Rossi win. He's going to be driving with red mist in his eyes. I think that was somebody's quote or his quote during the 500. So I think we're going to see him extra motivated to do well. He finished third in the first race last year and was, you know, up there fighting for the win before he overshot the corner there in the second race. So Rossi for the win at least once.
Okay, so I'm going to go strictly off of the driver rating system here. I don't really have a more educated way of doing this. So as far as the two predicted winners that I got Graham Rahal, who seems to always do well there, including the sweep they had there in 2017. And Scott Dixon has been very successful at Detroit, kind of more under the radar, obviously, to win last year, though. As far as those are going to struggle, I can't take Chilton because Jess did, but that is a very smart pick because that guy has sucked at Detroit. Can't take Ferrucci because that was another one that was taken. I picked Piggott in Fantasy IndyCar, so I can't really pick him because that's kind of hypocritical. Is it too late to change that? I don't know. So I guess I'll go to my next one here. I guess Zach Veach was pretty average there last year, so maybe he'll struggle this weekend. And let's see, can't pick Foyt because that's a cop-out. So the next one up for me is James Hinchcliffe. By process of elimination, James Hinchcliffe is the next lowest on the driver's ratings. Had a pretty average showing at both races last year, despite some good showings in 2017. So for no better reason, I'll just stick with the driver ratings on that one. And then real quick, just one driver, Mike, that needs to have a good weekend based on their performance at Indianapolis in the month of May.
Wow, that's a great question. Pato O'Ward not making the race after he gets signed to this Red Bull development contract. I mean, he has to put on a good showing to keep everybody at Red Bull happy and everybody at Carlin happy. So he needs to rebound and at least have a top 10 showing.
I am gonna say, man, this is a tough one, but Felix Rosenquist probably. He didn't have the worst month of May, but he definitely didn't have a great one either. So I think that he needs to come back out swinging and get his season back on track.
Mine is gonna be our favorite, Marco Andretti, just because he did show very well at Detroit last year and got the pole in the first race. And I mean, he did have the worst race at Indy. For even the guys who crashed, he had the worst race. So it's always tough because you know his job security is there. So it's not like he's ever under threat per se, but still, you got to get some self-respect back and have a good weekend after what happened last weekend. So, and I'm also picking him in fantasy. So fingers crossed. Every time I pick Marco, it never goes well for me, but Detroit's kind of a burner race for me every year anyway. So fingers crossed that it works out. All right, Mike, why don't you take us through our group pitfall here? I think this one was kind of a slam dunk for us three this weekend.
Yeah, I don't even know where to start with this one, but a columnist down in Florida said that after NASCAR merged with whatever company owns those tracks, that the Indy 500 should move to Saturday now that NASCAR has all this momentum. And yeah, Twitter literally exploded. I think that was the only time I've ever seen NASCAR fans and IndyCar fans who don't follow each other's respective forms of motorsports agree with each other. So that's the story. I'll turn it over to you guys for any opinions. I think being that it's a pitfall, we probably all agree, but Jess, why don't you start here?
Yeah, so I'm gonna go with, yeah, that's real cute. NASCAR's got a upswing. Wait, what? No, you're silly. And to think that the 500 is just gonna quote unquote switch days. Nope. Not gonna happen. I don't really think that there's much else that needs to be said there.
Well, it's just like the common thread for me on Twitter was just the arrogance that the race that hasn't been around as long, that doesn't get as good of ratings, that doesn't draw as many people, and that doesn't have the history that the other race has, while the one race has ratings that are going up, while the other has ratings that are just stagnant or going down, to ask them to switch their date instead of saying, maybe our formula is not working, maybe we should try a Saturday night or a Monday night or something else, to ask the better event, which has been widely accepted across the board as the better event, to change their formula and whatnot, is just incomprehensibly dumb. And I don't fathom what on earth the logic there was to write that piece. So yes, we are all three in unison on that one for sure.
Yeah. In the wise words of James Hinchcliffe,
it's adorable.
leave it at that. I mean, I'm sorry, Mr. Journalist, I won't call him out by name here, but when every journalist, NASCAR and IndyCar, and every IndyCar and NASCAR fan says, you're silly, you really made a terrible, terrible article. And I don't understand where this leverage that NASCAR and the ISC merger is going to propel them to be better than the Indy 500 or to help drivers run the double, because drivers have done it in the past just fine. So I'm confused about what this leverage is. I would like some clarification on that. But yeah, I mean, just probably as well thought out as when I said McLaren would have an Indy Lights team last year. But with that, I think we can wrap it up for the week. Hope everybody enjoyed the 500. And like Matt said, the three of us will all be in Detroit this weekend. Jess and I will probably be about three quarters awake the entire weekend. So if you come, please bring us coffee. And quick shout out to Eargasm Earplugs for their continued support. They were in my ears when I was down on pit lane during practice all month of May, and I can still hear and my ears aren't ringing. So they definitely work. And thank you to everybody who listened to all of our episodes throughout the entire month of May. I know there's probably 9 or 10 episodes out there, and some people might still be behind, but There's plenty to listen to and some great interviews like Tanner Watkins and I on a golf cart with Ben Hanley driving up and down pit lane. So definitely check it out and give us your opinions.
And real quick, shout out to all the servicemen and women in our country, because that's always what Memorial Day has been about. So special shout out to everybody for keeping us safe in our country.
Yes, what Matt said. And with that, Jess, why don't you go ahead and sign us off?
And guys, keep your lug nuts tight.
Here is the RaceCast weather forecast for the Detroit Grand Prix at Belle Isle Park. I'm meteorologist Doug Schneider. Friday at Belle Isle Park will be a beautiful day with sunny skies and high temperatures in the lower 70s. Then a cold front is expected to move through the Great Lakes region on Saturday. The exact timing of the front and the best chance of rain for Belle Isle is still a little uncertain, but there is about a 40% chance of showers and possibly a thunderstorm during the daylight hours. As of Wednesday afternoon, I think the best chance of showers and storms will be in the afternoon and evening, but a brief passing shower will be possible at any time of the day. High temperatures on Saturday afternoon will be in the mid-70s. Behind the cold front, high pressure will build into the Detroit area, providing a very nice day on Sunday. It'll be mostly sunny, humidity levels will be low, and afternoon high temperatures will be in the upper 60s. For the most up-to-date weather forecast, visit racecastweather.com.